Welcome to the Oregon Senate and General Government Committee. A lot on the docket today. Before we get started, a couple of announcements. First, SJR 48 will be carried over to Wednesday, and Senate Bill 1023 is a bill that we're not going to tackle this session. We're going to start off and open a public hearing on, Senate Bill 1023. We are going to tackle.
Thank you.
SCR 23, we are not going to tackle.
Yes, just
tackle. Ironic.
Well, you just use the words like that. Huh?
Yeah.
We're not doing SCR 23.
We are not. So let me open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1023. Senator Johnson is here. Did you want to come up with some of
folks? With the committee's permission, invite the mayor and the editor of the local newspaper up with me, and then I'll relinquish my seat, and there's one other testifier on this issue.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing this bill. The bill and the opportunity to be heard gives voice to the city and members of several distinguished Clatskanie families with respect to an ongoing debate with DSL as to the ownership of the beds and banks of the Clatskanie River. The mayor will set the scene. I have nothing more to say other than thank you for giving thoughtful consideration to this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Hass and distinguished committee members, my name is Diane Pohl, and I am the mayor of a wonderful small rural community we choose to say is the center of the universe, of Clatskanie, that's located in the coastal mountains of Oregon on Highway 30. We are before you today in support of Senate Bill 1023, asking that this legislature recognize private property ownership of certain lands within our boundaries for very specific reasons, which you will hear during testimony. With me today is Public Works Director Dave True, who is a licensed engineer and surveyor. Deborah Steele Hazen, fifth-generation Clatskanie resident and property owner, will also testify. Standing by to answer any questions is Martha Pagel of Schwab, Williamson & Wyatt, and Jay McCauley, consultant. They are experts the city and our citizens have retained for clarification of our case and our cause. Clatskanie City Manager Greg Hinkleman is also here for support and to answer any questions. We will present to you today reasons why this is a unique and compelling case unlike any other in Oregon. We have attempted to work with Division of State Lands, presenting this evidence, but to no avail. Upon hearing our case as presented before Secretary of State Kate Brown during a recent visit to our community, our esteemed Senator Betsy Johnson made a decision to come alongside by introducing the Senate bill before you, and for that we are very grateful. This issue predates statehood, and if not addressed in a positive way, has the potential to irreparably harm our city, small businesses, and citizens. I do not feel it will establish precedents for other areas, as this situation is unique to Clatskanie, and the deeded land claims granted by the federal government and recognized through the years by the state of Oregon. This issue also has to do with survival of a small rural community during these fragile economic times. Cities have the distinction of being the front line of government in providing basic services and public safety, yet we have the least ability to increase our revenue of any government in existence. Due to dwindling franchise fees, shrinking state shared revenues, and Measure 5 caps, we are watching every penny, looking at increased costs of service versus shrinking revenues. DSL is insisting the city sign leases for our existing water and sewer easements that have existed for decades. This sudden drain on our general fund impacts us greatly at this time. They have specified the lease application cost of $750 per lease for multiple leases, but have not revealed exactly what fees will be on riprap, boat launches, etc. One example would be we have a bridge that we own in Clatskanie. Underneath that bridge runs two water lines and two sewer lines. DSL has informed us that that would be four separate leases. There are new proposed rules from DSL that suggest doubling or even tripling those application fees. Both the existing and proposed new rules are very difficult to interpret and understand, particularly for our citizens and landowners. But the crux of our case before you is we do not feel DSL has proven that they indeed own and have authority over the lands along the Kalatskanai River that they are claiming. This river is under statutory control. They are basing their case on a report that is erroneous and misleading. We will present the same historical facts to you that we have presented to them that we believe preempts their claim. I would also refer you to ORS 274.025, Jurisdiction over Submersible and Submerged Lands Generally, a copy of which I have attached to this testimony. In conclusion, I am here not only in an official city capacity, but also as a resident of a community that has stood strong against many tides of economic downturns. We lost much of our economy when timber and fishing were minimalized, and many businesses closed or relocated. But our community rallied, and we have continued on with a positive attitude for the future and a love for our city. However, there comes a tipping point. This is where we are at this time, and this is why we are here asking for your consideration. Thank you for this opportunity to speak and present our unique case. I respectfully ask that Senate Bill 1023 be passed from this committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. And I will allow the experts here.
Okay, you can stay up there in case we have some questions.
Okay.
We'll let Ms. Hazen.
I believe Mr. True is
going to. Mr. True, okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is David True, and I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Kalatskanai. I have served as the engineer for the city for the past 16-plus years. I graduated from Oregon State University with a degree in civil engineering in 1977, and I'm a registered professional civil engineer and land surveyor in the state of Oregon. I was a supervisor for waterway engineering programs with the department, then known as the Division of State Lands, from June 1983 to June 1986. We all realize that when Oregon was admitted into the Union on February 14, 1859, title to the beds and banks of all navigable and tidal waterways became vested in the state to the elevation of either the ordinary high water line or the mean high tide line. This would include waterways that were susceptible to being navigable at the time of statehood. The fact is not in dispute. Furthermore, it is recognized that the present-day Kalatskanai River is both navigable and tidally influenced. There is an abundance of evidence of commercial navigation from the late 1800s to the present. These facts are also not in dispute. What is in dispute is the fact that the Department of State Lands is making ownership claims to the submerged and submersible land of the Kalatskanai River in its present-day configuration and location based solely on the evidence of commercial navigation and tidal influence. Navigation and tidal influence are only part of the evidence required to determine the boundaries of ownership between state and private and other local government entities. Other types of evidence that must be examined to complete an ownership determination include pre-statehood land transactions, in this case between the federal government and early pioneers of the area through the Donation Land Claimed Act, acts of avulsion, which are sudden, violent acts, either man-made or naturally occurring, that change the course and configuration of the waterway, court rulings, federal and state, that may have awarded title to portions of the submerged and submersible land of the waterway, and post-statehood land transactions by the State Land Board that passed land title of the submerged and submersible land of the waterway. We have found evidence in all categories that lead us to the conclusion that DSL does not own the submerged and submersible land of the Kalatskanai River in the area under consideration. Prehood state transactions, and you have a packet of exhibits there with this report. We have researched the donation land claims of Elihu G. Bryant, which is claim number 37, and Isaac Wagner, claim number 38. These land claims include a portion of the Kalatskanai River in the downtown area, shown on the present-day aerial photograph, which is Exhibit A. The property owners that are actively participating in the ownership dispute with DSL are shown on Exhibit A. Although the patent or the title to the acreage within both land claims was not issued by the federal government until 1866, the residency requirement of 4 years and the certification of the residency requirement was filed in the government land office in Oregon City in March of 1857, 2 years to Oregon being admitted to the Union. I quote from a portion of a letter to Mr. Steve Purchase of the DSL from the Department of Justice dated July 30, 2007, which is Exhibit B. that discusses the time at which property title passes from the federal government to the claimant. Quote, under the Act, a claimant had a vested right to a patent after residing on a land claim for the requisite four-year period. Sylvester versus the State of Washington. In many cases, the actual patent was not issued until many years after the claim had vested. However, the right to a patent, once vested, is treated as equivalent to a patent issued. Stark versus Stars. That is to say that when a patent is issued, title relates back to the inception of the patentee's right, i.e., the fourth anniversary of the date claimant settled on and began cultivating the land, unquote. In the conclusion portion of the letter, it is pointed out that, quote, federal patents issued prior to statehood will only be found to convey lands lying below high water mark if the patent expressly conveys the lands lying below high water mark and recites a valid purpose for the lands lying below the high water mark, unquote. We believe the Government Land Office plat, Exhibit C, and the transcribed survey notes of the Government Land Office surveyor, Exhibits D and E, who set the boundaries of both DLCs number 37 and number 38, indicate the federal government intended to pass title to all of the land within the claim boundaries, including any submerged and submersible land of the Klatskanai River that may have existed at the time the claim was filed in 1857. The GLO plat, Exhibit C, does not indicate the river existed in any substantial form or configuration when both claims became vested. Furthermore, the transcribed field notes of the survey of both of the claims, notification number 7930 and notification number 7917, exhibits D and E, indicate the acreage within the claim area included buildings, bottomland, trees, and creek bottom. The DSL plat, exhibit F, probably drawn originally in the 1870s, indicates there is a river in the area, but it is located well to the east and north of the present downtown area of Klatskanai. In fact, this plat shows Klatskanai city center being located more than a mile downriver of its present-day location. Our investigation into this pre-statehood federal conveyance leads us to the conclusion that the Klatskanai River did not exist in any substantial dimension enough to even have it shown as a mere line on early DSL and GLO plats in the present-day downtown area of the city. Its present location is explained by documented channel improvements and reconfiguration of the river, primarily done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Evidence of avulsion. It appears that the primary source of avulsion in the disputed area is by channel improvements conducted under the direction of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. As stated earlier, the DSL plat, Exhibit F, indicates the city center of Klatskanai is located more than a mile downstream of its present location. Early Corps maps show a steamboat landing facility near the mouth of the Klatskanai River as it enters what is now known as Beaver Slough. This probably is as far upriver as cargo ships could travel prior to channel improvements in the Klatskanai and could be a reason that the city center was shown down near the steamboat landing. Exhibit G and Exhibit H, they're together, but Exhibit G is a photograph of the Klatskanai River looking across the waterway in a southerly direction, standing on the Lillick property. Refer to Exhibit H for the location and direction of the view as it relates to the present-day river. This photograph was taken in 1882 and is a part of the Melvina Barr collection, who was a descendant of one of the original pioneer families to have settled in the Klatskanai area. Some channel improvements have been made by 1882, but note how narrow and small the river appears. Also note how the bank across the river slopes gradually towards the building and the lack of steepened banks on either side of the river. Dikes, which exist today, have not yet been constructed. The present-day buildings are right over the water, and the gradient on the banks is much steeper. There is substantial documented evidence of channel realignment of the Klatskanai River just downstream of the downtown area, as well as channel widening, dike construction, and channel deepening in the city center area. Exhibit I is a 1912 survey of the Paul Birkenfeld property. Note the old channel location and the straightened section in between. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did this work around 1902. The survey is located just downstream from the Malonis property, which is shown on Exhibit A. The channel was also widened and deepened throughout the downtown area. Avulsion studies have not been fully completed at this time, but it is evident that substantial man-made improvements to the river have taken place as the need for river commerce to a growing population increased. The 1902 Circuit Court case, Omar Bryant versus Hannah Conyers et al. This case was an estate settlement among various parties for property in the estate of E.S. Bryant. The important item to note is the judge, Thomas McBride, ruled that the property settlement be decided as per the survey of three
Excuse me for interrupting, but I did want to say we have all of your testimony up here in writing that will be included in our record on this, and I notice you have three or four more pages here.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering, given that, if you want to just move to the conclusion, and then we could go through some Q&A.
Okay.
It might be more helpful.
All right, certainly. I'll just read the conclusion. In the short time I have to testify, this is a general summary of the evidence we have uncovered thus far, given our limited time to study the matter and our limited financial resources. What is most troubling to me as a professional engineer and land surveyor, and even as an ex-employee of the DSL, is a lack of ownership research performed by DSL on this matter. Most of the information we have uncovered is easily found and certainly has been available for DSL review. Thank you.
Okay, Sazen,
would you like to go? Chair Hess, distinguished committee members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Deborah Steele Hazen. I'm a fifth-generation resident of Clatskanie. My children are the sixth generation. My grandchildren are the seventh generation. One of the hats I wear in our community is as a founding board member of the Clatskanie Historical Society. The first 13 families who arrived in the Clatskanie area did so during the winter of 1852-53. Among them were Elihu Bryant, Isaac Wagner, and H.B. Hastings. Those three filed claims under the Federal Donation Land Claimed Act of 1850 in the spring of 1853, as Mr. True has said, in the territorial office in Oregon City. As you have heard, the Clatskanie River, as it exists now, did not exist then. The creek was too insignificant to be shown on the donation land claim maps, but survey points in the creek were used in the property descriptions, and the claims included creek bed as well as upland property. In the spring of 1857, 2 years before Oregon statehood, Bryant, Wagner, and Hastings returned to the territorial office in Oregon City with witnesses to the fact that they had cultivated the land as required by the Federal Donation Land Claim Act and the property passed into their hands at that point. The Wagner, Bryant, and Hastings land claims through which the creek was subsequently channelized, deepened, and widened became the heart of the community, of our community's commercial district. My great-great-grandparents and great-grandparents first came to the Clatskanie area in the early 1880s. I have written the history of my family. It's condensed, believe it or not, but I'll condense it even more for my oral testimony. My great-great-grandfather served as town marshal. He fell to his death on the Wagner donation land claim a few yards from the Clatskanie River, what is now the Clatskanie River. His son, my great-great-uncle Paul Birkenfeld, is the Paul Birkenfeld whom Mr. True referred to in his testimony. He farmed that land for over 50 years and died of a sudden heart attack as he was walking across it one day in the early 50s when I was a little girl. My great-grandfather owned and operated a store on the Wagner land claim within yards of the Clatskanie River. He served as mayor. The Clatskanie Chief newspaper was established in 1891, the same year that the town was established. It was owned and operated by a number of different parties up until 1922 when a young man named Art Steele, my grandfather, came to town and married the mayor's daughter, bought the paper for $10 and the agreement to take over the payments on the linotype machine. He believed in a community advocacy form of journalism, which my father subsequently followed, as I have endeavored to do myself. My grandfather, among his other leadership roles, was on the Development Council for the Bonneville Power Administration, and for many, many decades on the Lower Columbia River Improvement, Highway 30 Improvement Committee. Through those roles and others, he got to know well people such as Mark Hatfield and Tom McCall, Glenn Jackson and Wayne Morris, all of whom I had the privilege of meeting as a little girl and as a young woman. And just for your enjoyment, I have included a picture of my grandparents with Tom McCall when Tom McCall came to Clatskanie in 1971, a few months before my grandparents' 50th anniversaries as editors and publishers of the Clatskanie Chief, and honored them. I also included the cover page of that he autographed of the speech he gave that night that has all of his hand notes scribbled over that. Less than a year after Governor McCall's visit to Clatskanie, my grandmother died of a fatal heart attack suffered at her desk at the chief office on the Wagner claim a few yards from the Clatskanie River. In 1993, my father suffered a heart attack at his desk in the chief office, et cetera, et cetera. He survived that heart attack, went blind as a side effect, but continued his work to support his community, which had been a lifelong passion, indeed a passion of several generations of our family. He ran for and served on the Clatskanie City Council as a blind man until his death, and was posthumously awarded the community's highest award for community service. I am now the third generation of my family to serve as publisher and editor of the Clatskanie Chief. My daughter Amanda works with me. She's the fourth generation. Her two children come to the office after school every day and help out. So we have five generations with the Clatskanie Chief now. My husband Phil Hazen is a third generation resident of Clatskanie. He is a much decorated Vietnam combat veteran. He is the second generation of his family to operate Hazen Hardware out of a store on the Wagner claim of the near the banks of the Clatskanie River. His family has operated business out of that property for 60 years. We are not the only one of these families involved in this dispute with the DSL who has a record of multi-generational service to our community. And some of them are here today. Many of them are veterans. They have paid taxes, provided essential products, services, and employment in our community. They have served on our school board, our city council, our park and recreation district. They have donated land, materials, labor to build our libraries, our park facilities, to create cultural opportunities, a healthy environment, scholarships for our youth. My point is, we are good citizens. We are not trespassers. That is what the DSL called us when they came to town in 2006, looked at our property and concluded without doing the research that the state owned the land which was granted into private hands 153 years ago. Up until then, there had never been a question about the private ownership of the Clatskanie Riverbed. ORS 274.025 specifically allows for the submersible and submerged lands that have become vested in private individuals, and that is certainly the case with the pre-statehood land claims within the city of Clatskanie. The public right of the river, public's right to use the river, has never been limited by our ownership and will not be limited by Senate Bill 1023. It is specifically protected by it. We are not asking for any changes. We are simply asking for the legislature to recognize what was granted in 1857, reaffirmed by the court case in 1902, to which Mr. True referred, and acknowledged by the State Land Board and Governor Douglas McKay in 1949. Frankly, we are amazed and appalled that the DSL has expended so much time and money in trying to force leases on the city of Clatskanie and a handful of small private business owners. In our case, the DSL contends that a foot or two of the back of the hardware store's warehouse hangs over the mean water line of the river. An area that deeds and title searches going back to the 1880s, which we have in our possession, state very clearly that we own. The majority of the private property owners involved in our situation have vowed that we will tear down our structures to behind the high water line rather than to submit to DSL leases. We will not lie and say that the DSL owns the property that we have owned, stewarded, invested in, and paid property taxes on for decades and decades. In the case of the Lillick property, there are docks and moorages available to the public and protecting the riverbank, which will be torn out. If the DSL is successful in overturning historical fact and our private property rights, where will they then be? They will not be collecting leases on our property. It will take years for the agency to recoup what they have spent. It defies common sense. For 130 years, seven generations of our family have literally left our blood, sweat, tears, and lives on this land. I will not betray everything that they have stood for: good government, truth, and freedom. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you to Senator Johnson for bringing this issue forward. I will say this, that everyone up here has a deep affinity for Oregon history, and we're sensitive to that. Plus, we have two former journalists who have an affinity for what you did and your grandfather. And I was thinking, seven generations of Oregonians, if you do the math, you can't get much more beyond that. I think if you go eight generations, you're walking over from Alaska or something. So I know we have some questions up here. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. I feel like I'm trying to be a quick study here. But I have a question. I know one of you said that you have some attorneys here, and maybe they're going to testify. Because you're citing statutes and cases all the way back to 1907, and we've got a stack of exhibits. I kind of feel like I'm in a courtroom instead of a legislature. So if you could talk a little bit about what you've done. Obviously, you're having a dispute with DSL. So what legal steps have you tried to take to resolve it within the judicial system?
Well, maybe I'll start. The first landowners received their letters from the DSL saying they were in trespass and would be, if they didn't pay a $750 fine, fill out numerous pages of paperwork. Within 30 days, they would be fined up to $1,000 a day for trespassing. And that was in the fall of 2006. Some of us didn't receive our letters until the spring of 2007. Since then, we wrote to the DSL, presented them with a number of the documents and information that we have presented to you. And they replied with a court case that was on the wrong river. There's a Clatskanie River in South Clatsop County. It's about 50 miles away from the Clatskanie River where we are. They also did a navigability study that they presented that has many errors in it. And then after we met with them, after Senator Johnson arranged for a meeting with them, and we didn't hear anything from them for months. That was when we got the navigability study that has a number of errors in it. And then we didn't hear from them for almost a year. And then we got letters earlier, in the late summer, early fall of 2009, which basically was pay your $750, make out your application. And that was when we hired Martha Pagel as our attorney.
Thank you. For the record, members of the committee, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt, and I'm here representing the Clatskanie group here. And just to briefly respond to the question from Senator Bonamici, that legally the situation typically arises where DSL identifies uses that it believes are occurring on state-owned lands and provides notice to the landowners. That occurred here, and as you heard, there was a pushback from that and a kind of response that they didn't believe that was required. At one point, the Department of State Lands issued a final order saying that they had made their final decision and basically sticking to their guns. When I was brought in, I contacted Director Louise Soliday and met with her, and she agreed to rescind that order. So now we're in a process legally of kind of regrouping and seeing where we go. And in the meantime, this special session came forward, and Senator Johnson filed the bill that you have in front of you. In the absence of this legislation, we would continue efforts to try to present our factual information to the Department of State Lands, try to negotiate them with them, and hopefully avoid winding up. If there is no resolution, it would ultimately get before a court in some kind of a quiet title action. Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was waiting for Martha to get here. So, I understand the issue here. What I'm trying to understand, if you can help me, is why we need this bill. Quite honestly, when I read ORS 274.025, it basically says if you've got title, the state can't take it from you. And this is a bigger issue than just this one case, because there are a lot of landowners that their deed, and you know, is a deed to the center of the river. And you know, I'm not sure when this became law. Do you remember? Were you involved? Or did it go? Or did it predate that?
Predates me.
Okay, but it's, you know, it's quite clearly that the state owns everything that somebody else doesn't already own. Okay, and so if there are deeds here, the ownership is already determined. It's in law. So why do we need to do this? I understand you're trying to, you know, in my opinion, this is a massive overreach by DSL, and it's a money grab by DSL. But the state law is on the side of the deeded landowner. So I'm trying to figure out why we need to do this when it's already in law.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I know there are representatives here from the Department of State Lands who would kind of present their explanation of why they need to do this. I can think back to the days when I was the director of the Department of State Lands, back when it was the Division of State Lands.
Mm-hmm.
Those statutes were already on the books. And I can say the short answer is that DSL doesn't necessarily recognize what's in a deed. They go through their own evaluation, and they're looking at the facts. In this case, we think that we have also presented facts to substantiate what are in the deeds. We have more process to go through to present yet more facts. But you'll have situations with landowners across the state who have deeds that mm-hmm. purport to convey, that they think convey, and that they would assert conveys legal title, but that might not be recognized by the state.
Senator Cruz.
So the state's saying, to hell with the law, we're going to make our own rules. Okay, fine. I just needed to know that.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of these properties, the donation land claim, predates statehood?
All of them.
All of them do. I thought that was pretty clearly understood, that those lands that predated statehood, the title vests with the property owner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, the law is clear on that, and I think what it boils down to is a factual issue and findings, and in this case, at least to this point, the Department of State Lands has not recognized the facts that we've brought forward. The donation land claim, the legal description, does not refer to the river. It does not call out a boundary like you might expect. It does refer to the creek, Kutskanai Creek, as was brought forward in the testimony of Ms. Hazen. So there's a dispute over how what that really means. From our point of view, what that means is that there was not a navigable river on that land at the time that those donation land claims were prepared. If there had been, it would have been written as such. But we have not been able to carry the day yet on that.
Mr. Chair, follow up. This bill is specific to these properties. The issue is a public policy issue that probably is much bigger than the Kutskanai problem. Would it be helpful if this bill was amended to ask the Supreme Court for declaratory judgment that would set the case law? It would set law for the state of Oregon with respect to this issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, that's a tough question, because so often it's hard to separate out the general legal principles from the facts at play. And I think we do have a general sense of the legal issues and the legal principles. but we have a dispute over the facts here, and we haven't been able to make headway with the department. I think that's one reason why you see this kind of special legislation in front of you. It may be that there's a general point to be made there with respect to how the donation land claim would be interpreted, but that's a tough one to respond to. I'm not sure I have a good answer for you. Did you have a...
Mr. Chair, Senators, your question, Senator Cruz, is you know, why? What happens is when the DSL comes in and sends lease letters to folks and they, you know, you have to pay this or in 30 days you can face $1,000 a day civil penalty. So while you can say that it's state law, it's if your facts aren't recognized and if you turn in information and then it's not processed, and 8 months later, the individuals get the letter again. So, I mean, it's one person against the state. So that's what initiated this action. So it's fine to say that it's a state law, but trying to prove it and get around one person against a state agency is very, very complicated.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morse got a good point. It'd be nice to have something clear cut. I mean, quite honestly, this is one of the least ambiguous pieces of law I've read in a while, you know, and it would not be too hard, I wouldn't think, to determine when this became law, and it's really simple. If somebody had title before this became law, they have title. You know, if title was conveyed after the fact, then they don't. Then the state has title. But, I mean, there's clearly a clear, bright line at some point in time in the history of the state when this became law. And, you know, I've got property deeds that are deeded to the center of the river. And I guarantee you they preceded this because they're back in the 20s and 30s. So, not that I ever intend on doing anything with the bottom of the river, because you really can't farm it very well. But, you know, I mean, there are situations like this, and there are probably other communities that are potentially trapped in the same thing. I have no problem with fixing your problem, but I think Senator Morse is right. There's a bigger issue here that it would be nice to have an answer on. So.
Okay, well, we have other people here on this bill, and we have other bills. So let me see who else is here. John Lilich, you're one of the property owners. Did you want to? You're okay. In the city of Klatskanai,
that was me.
Greg, you're okay?
Yeah.
All right. So,
Mr. Chair, if I might, just one additional piece of information. I'm not clear how much of these properties are in dispute. Is it the property clear out to Williamson or this whatever the street is? I guess it's not Williamson, but.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, it's everything on Exhibit A.
The red lines?
Yeah, those are the individuals that are involved in the property dispute, but that the whole stretch of the river, what the bill reads is we feel that the river is privately owned everywhere within the city limits. But
Mr. Chair, if I might ask Martha to come forward and at least show us specifically the property that is in dispute. Portions of or all of?
Well, if I can refer to this.
Everything in the river.
We've got the DSL claims are for leasing any structures that are located below the line of ordinary high water, as it's shown here on the, just as you can see, the river. The ownership boundaries, Dave, can you point those out as to what are shown on are the DLC boundaries shown?
Well, the DLCs are not shown, but the individual properties and the as it relate would go, this is a parcel to the center of the river. And like for Wygant, same, he owns from basically from the bridge over to, there's a very small parcel that Williamson owns, but it owns goes to the center of the river.
And that's what's marked here in the red lines. And the ownership.
That's their property. Mm-hmm. That's a portion of their property that's involved in the dispute with DSL.
Okay. All right, let's hear from DSL. We have the purchase here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of the Department of State Lands. I'm here today to provide testimony on Senate Bill 1023 that, if enacted, would waive the state's ownership of the submerged and submersible lands of the Clascanine River within certain donated land claims. The department is concerned about this legislation because it's inconsistent with the provisions of ORS 274040, among other statutes and opinions of the Attorney General. There are about 4 points I would really like to make. One is that when considering whether or not to enact this proposed legislation, several things are important to keep in mind. First and foremost is submerged and submersible lands underlying the Clascanine River and many other waterways in Oregon were acquired by statehood as successor sovereign at the time of statehood. That's a legalese for the federal government held the waterways in trust, passed them to the state in trust to ensure that the use of the public for fishing, recreation, navigation, and commerce under the public trust doctrine. The department is the agency responsible for managing public waterways to benefit the public or those just publicum rights enjoyed by the public and the revenues associated with that under ORS 274040. The department requires that private and public uses which take submerged and submersible lands of these waterways out of public use to compensate the public for that loss. The state was not a party to the 1902 litigation referred to in this bill. Therefore, the ownership was not affected by the decision in that case. The State Land Board has acted as an owner of tidally influenced section of the Clascanine River since statehood and has authorized uses on the river underlying the waterway. This bill refers to State Land Board action in 1949 when the State Land Board, acting as an owner of a parcel within one of the donated land claims and its role as successor to the World War I Veteran Aid Commission. I would also like to point out that if this bill was to be enacted, it would set a major precedent in that in the first time in Oregon's history, the state legislature would grant submerged lands of a public-owned waterway to a private ownership. It would also result in loss of revenue to the common school fund. In closing, the department has serious concerns about Senate Bill 1023 because we believe it's poor public policy to grant state ownership away from the state to private landowners without compensation. We also believe it's inconsistent with the legislative requirements of ORS 274040. However, the department is committed to work to continue to work with landowners along the river to resolve existing unauthorized public and private uses associated with the state-owned waterways. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions for Mr. Purchase, Senator Bonamici?
No, thanks.
Senator Metzger?
Yeah, thank you. In your testimony, a couple of questions. Number one is, you're talking about the state ownership of the submerged and submersible lands as if by fiat you have already made a decision on it, and they have presented evidence that the state does not own that. And my question is, how come the department has not opined to the city and those the residents who are the subject of this action on the claims that they have that they had rights to those prior to statehood? How, you can't just say that we own it and present evidence and I'm just going to ignore it like we usually do at the Department of State Lands. Where is that argument and where is the printed document that shows that their evidence is not correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, let me respond this way. One is that the disputes are a factual dispute. And the landowners who claim that they have a title or interest in the property based on a donated land claim is based on the fact that they applied for the donated land claim prior to statehood. In order to understand, it's really important to understand what the donated land claims did and did not do. When they presented that evidence to us, we went to the Bureau of Land Management and asked them for an opinion of what, in fact, the federal land grant granted. Bureau of Land Management referred to us, and we have that in writing. I can certainly provide that to the committee, that, in fact, the donated land claim was approved after statehood. The state had already become the owner of all tidally influenced rivers and all rivers that were navigable, and the federal government could not pass title to the river after statehood because it already passed title to the river to the state. In that same document, it also mentions that the surveyors did not meander the waterway or recognize the waterway in the donated land claim, and therefore the Bureau felt that the donated land claim did not pass title to the river. And this would be consistent with all of the donated land claims statewide. If the river was not called out specifically in the donated land claim, it did not pass title to the river because, in fact, the state had already had title to the river.
All right, so a follow-up question,
sure.
Mr. Chair. Yes. So tell me how this works. We've had testimony that at the time of statehood suggests that there was no navigable river at that location, that the Klatskanai, whatever it was somewhere else. So what is the navigable part that the state would own? Where it existed at statehood? Where after channeling by the Corps of Army Engineers it is now? Do they get to claim both? Or does that change depending on where the river meanders and the title goes back? I'm just curious for not just this situation, but what happens when that, because that happens often with rivers. That's why we have the low riparian land. So how does that title been affected when that changes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I'll try to give you a short answer to a very difficult legal question. A river moves basically by two ways. One is by natural meandering, and the other one is by some avulsive act. Natural meanderings, as a stream meanders over time, it moves slowly. As it moves slowly, the state's ownership stays within the bed and the bank of the river, and it moves with the river as the river meanders around. And we would own to the ordinary high water line in that case because the ownership stays within the bed and the bank of the river. On a more difficult issue is what's called the Avulsive Act, and there's been a lot of discussion about that here today. An Avulsive Act is where someone comes in and channelizes a river, cuts out the meanders. Typically, that's what happens. They cut out the meanders, and they create a new channel. When they create a new channel, the new channel is owned by the private party. It's not owned by the state. The old original meanders, however, are still owned by the state. So on these rivers where they've been channelized or reconstructed or whatever by the Corps of Engineers, ownership becomes even more complex. That's kind of a short answer to a kind of a tough legal question and a factual question about how the river moved.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because my final comment on this is that, again, we don't have all the facts, but just our brief presentation today, at least what I heard was suggesting that where the river now is as a result of channeling, so that this would be, quote, as you said, under private ownership because that wasn't, and wherever it was under a tidal influence and navigable in 1859 is where the state owns, and that would seem to be a dispute of fact as to where the heck that was compared to today. And I assume that would be one of the issues that you feel is in dispute. But even if it is in dispute, doesn't the department have some responsibility to prove that it was there?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
to make the same claim, you know.
That is correct, and that's one of the reasons why, after meeting with the landowners, we commissioned a study by Dr. Beckham from Portland State University to take a look at the history of the river and its navigable history and its channelization history, so we could try to determine if, in fact, there was enough facts there for us to agree with the landowners. And what Dr. Beckham found was in this particular location there was not enough evidence to suggest that the river was not where it was supposed to be. So I think that's why we have a factual dispute today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Morris?
No, Mr. Chair, this issue seems to beg for a solution. And to ask us to do it might be a little bit difficult, but to ask the courts to do it would seem to me to be reasonable.
Mr. Chair,
for the record, Betsy Johnson, Senator, District 16, I just can't let some of the comments go without challenge. Dr. Beckham is a well-respected, well-known historian at Lewis and Clark College. He's a personal friend of mine. He's not a forensic hydrologist. We have the river in his report located in the wrong section. And so to allow the statement to go that Dr. Beckham's work was dispositive is simply erroneous. What we have here is a factual problem, and it is precedential, and that's why this bill is as large as it could be. And I think what I'm going to suggest to my constituents and their lawyer is that we thoughtfully review your proposal, and you may see us back in 2011 with a different version of the bill. I think the point here, though, colleagues, is that in the name of the Common School Fund, we have thrown common sense out the window. The amount of money that DSL has spent trying to disprove the claims of these seventh generation community leaders is stunning. And if we're going to revisit this in every one of these small communities where action over time has moved the river, and one of the gentlemen sitting behind me has some fascinating photographs where he has laid historic maps against aerial photographs now, and it's clear the river's all over the place. But the point of the story here is, and I say this respectfully because the legislature gave DSL direction to help maximize the return to the Common School Fund, but at some point we've got to do a cost-benefit ratio and figure out why putting these people behind me, these Oregonians, through the grinder that they've been through with the prospect of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of legal bills to prove their case against de minimis proceeds from leases is insane. And we, I think, at the legislature, have to stop this. We have to take a more active role in what the DSL is doing with respect to its interaction with citizens. I saw the first letters that these citizens got, and they were tantamount to, dear trespasser, move or we'll fine you till your socks roll up and down. There were apologies issued for those letters. They were so egregious. And so this is not a settled issue. And whether this bill moves forward out of this committee or not in a short session remains to be seen. But what I can tell you is that citizens like these are all over the state of Oregon with the same issues, the same problems, and I think we'll be back perhaps with Senator Morris's advice and help with a different way to get a resolution to this vexing problem. Thank you.
Senator Johnson, thank you. And thank you to those families that came from ways away. And we will try again and keep looking at this issue that has been so elusive to your families for literally a century. So thank you for your engagement. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1023, and I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 50. We have a couple of state legislators with us who will kick that off. Well, one of them could.
It's meaningless, I realize, but you can't even direct it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Administrator Richardson, why don't you give us a hand?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 50 directs the Superintendent of Public Instruction to promote Chinese language study in Oregon schools. The Dash 1 amendments indicate that it would request rather than direct the superintendent to promote Chinese language.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I don't know who wants to go first.
I'll kick it off. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator in Senate District 7, representing West Eugene, North Eugene, and Junction City. Before you, you have a Senate Joint Resolution 50, and it's pretty self-explanatory, and I'll just give you just a very brief reason why I think this resolution is important. Currently, if you were to go to nearly any high school in the state of Oregon, you would find the availability of certainly of Spanish and perhaps French for learning. In some of the larger high schools, you might also find German. You may, in a few schools, find Japanese, Russian available. But it is quite difficult to find Chinese, Mandarin, Chinese language learning programs in the state of Oregon. Yet, Chinese is the most spoken language on the planet. China, as you know, has 1.4 billion people and growing, projected to be the largest economy in the world by the year 2030. And I think that it's time for Oregonians to start thinking about what are we doing to prepare ourselves to work with a rising nation. We don't have to adopt their politics. We don't have to adopt their view of the world. But I can tell you that it goes a long way to be able to work with another country when you have a certain number of folks within your own that can at least speak their language. So that's kind of my motivation in getting this this resolution going, and that's supportive of a policy bill that's moving to the House as well. So, and with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues for their comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dennis Richardson. I represent House District 4, which is parts of Jackson, Josephine County, and I've had the benefit of being able to go to China on several different occasions representing delegations from this body, and have had the opportunity to see the growth, the development, the progressions taking place there as they become, as they refer to it, a member of the community of nations. As we look ahead, it's obvious that that economy is going to be a driving force in the world. I mean, they are looking at a GDP this year of 10.5. It was 9% when it went back up. I mean, they've had a GDP of over 9% for the last decade to two decades. It is just absolutely incredible, the growth that's taking place there. And Oregon stands in a unique position to be a gateway to the Orient. And one thing that we need to do is to help make sure that our students are participating in this change that's taking place in this century. And so we need to assure that they have the opportunity to learn Chinese language. We can buy goods from China without speaking Chinese. We can go and arrange for them to manufacture our goods and send them back to us, but you can't sell goods from America to China without being able to speak Chinese. We need to assure that our students have this facet available to them if they like by having the opportunity to learn Mandarin. The Chinese government is participating in a program that enables Chinese teachers to come to schools that invite them. It's called the Confucius Classroom System. They're in 88 countries, over 500 Confucius classrooms, and in Oregon we have one, and that's in St. Mary's School in Medford. We now have two universities that are kind of regional direction. They're called Confucius Institutes, PSU and University of Oregon. And so what this bill does is kind of further the promotion of learning Chinese in Oregon schools, which is vitally important for a global education for the 21st century for Oregon students. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42, and it's a pleasure to join my colleagues here in support of SJR 50. I want to touch very briefly on the question, why this resolution and why now? The Senator mentioned that there is a companion piece of policy legislation in the House. I'm pleased to report to you that on the floor today, that companion piece of legislation passed out of the House unanimously. And we are looking forward to sending a strong signaling effect both to our partners abroad as well as to schools across Oregon that this is an area where we feel Oregon is poised to have a unique advantage and a competitive role in a global economy. We are looking at an application cycle and a partnership cycle in establishing the Confucius Classrooms and Institutes that the representative mentioned, where we have the ability now to move forward on these agreements and take advantage of a resource that's out there for Oregon students. It's not a mandate. It's not setting a policy in stone, but what it is directing and requesting and expressing the intent of the state of Oregon that this is a direction in which we are interested in pursuing and that we believe that Mandarin education is going to be an important part of our economic future. So thank you for hearing this joint resolution today.
Thank you all. Any questions? Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a subject that I have some background in. My daughter, when she was still in high school, wanted to learn Chinese language, and we were fortunate enough to find a tutor at Oregon State University that she started, and then eventually through her university work, she acquired a proficiency, and her major was in Chinese language and history. Subsequently worked in China and is residing in Taiwan today with her husband, who's a Chinese national. He's an executive in the world's largest shoe company that's headquartered in Taichung, Taiwan. So I have some interest in this subject that you bring forward. In 2006, I secured a $30,000 foundation grant for Western Oregon University, who had an interest at that time in their computer science department, to create a pilot program that would reach out and provide an avenue of instruction. And in fact, they did have some pilot work that was done. Worked with the superintendent at that time, but there just wasn't that inertia to get serious about this issue. So I have long recognized the importance of language instruction, and we're woefully deficient in this state and in the nation. It's an interesting resolution in some ways, but it's a very, very important topic if we are going to become engaged in a meaningful way in this trade that we have with China. That, in fact, we heard today from the I think it was a state economist that China is our largest trading partner. And so, how do we get to first? How do we even get to the plate? That's the question. You're suggesting that these Confucius classrooms would be an avenue of doing that. There may be other ways as well, but it's an important issue.
And that is an interesting distinction between trade missions and understanding the language. When I was a young reporter, I went to China, I went to the Fujian province and talked about the need for trade and all of this, but this is, as you articulated, a more just a nuanced part of how to really do business. And Representative Bailey, if I'm not mistaken, you speak Chinese.
Do I, Mr. Chair? <It's> yes.
Well, should have buhao.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Edwards and Representatives Richardson and Bailey, for bringing this forward, which I'll support. I think it's just such a small piece, however. I spent a lot of time years ago studying the benefits of early language learning for young students and believe that all students in Oregon should be studying a second language. I understand the reasons for promoting Chinese over other languages, but the learning benefits that accrue to students who study another language go beyond. It doesn't even matter sometimes which language it is, because the connections that are made in the brain, which typically start to close up at about the age 11 or 12, that explains why when you try to learn another language when you're an adult, it's much harder than as a child. So language immersion programs cost a bit extra money to get started, but once they get started, it doesn't require an additional teacher. It only requires a bilingual teacher. So I'm a strong supporter of more language immersion programs. I know that the Portland Public Schools does have at least one Mandarin immersion program, and I think our state is so far behind in that we really absolutely need to start looking at that, so our children of the future can grow up to be bilingual or trilingual. So thank you for bringing this forward. I wish it went further. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on SJR 50. Open at the work session on SJR 50. Just for the record, we have -1 amendments that are supported by the Department of Education, and you'll notice that the main difference is they request rather than direct the superintendent to move forward on this. So,
Mr. Chair, move a -1 amendment to SJR 50.
Senator Cruz moves a -1 amendment to SJR 50.
Don't bang the gavel till you've seen if we are going to vote for it.
Good point. Any discussion? Objection? -1s are adopted.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move SJR 50 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
That's why I gave you the script. Be adopted.
It'd be adopted. You're right. You're right. I'm sorry. I would have known that if it was January instead of February.
Senator Cruz moves the SJR 50 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Metzger? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly don't disagree with any of the testimony from our fine colleagues and some of the ones from my colleagues here. It's just that, reflecting on this, I think it's just disappointing when, and I know the comment about going further, and I would be supportive of that if we found an avenue. When we think of the report that we received a few months ago that, at tremendous cost, our English as second language learners after 5 years still aren't learning English, and it should be a year or two, and yet we keep spending money and we're not doing that. I think about our talented and gifted and encouraged, and that's not just in language but in everything else, and we spend a measly $200,000 in the entire state, the State Department, to fund somebody to give people ideas over the phone. And yet we recognize how important that is, especially in the economy, and our talented and gifted people who should, in all these arenas, should be encouraged and have tools available. And then encouraging the superintendent of public instruction. To me, it is sad to have to say we have to encourage a state leader to do something that would really be good, when they can just do it themselves and we don't have to pass a bill. It's almost like acknowledging that, we don't have leadership on some of those issues. So I'll vote for it because I understand that, but I think it's just sad that we have to, do these and kind of encouraging things when it seems like such a natural thing that that's what our people should be doing. So
thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similar to Senator Metzger, this is symbolic. It carries no weight except it is symbolic. But when you look at all of the issues we've got in education today, and it seems like wherever you look, we have problems. And the fact that at this point, when you look at ESL, we're having trouble teaching English, and now we're going to teach Chinese. There's clearly, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there are some fundamental changes we need to look at in the way we're approaching education, and clearly this would be one of them. But we're looking at big study on facilities right now. We got that going. We've got mandates for kindergarten. We got mandates for PE. There is a lot of stuff hanging on the vine of the Department of Ed right now. So I'm glad that this was modified to a suggestion because we don't want to task Morgan back there with too much stuff to do. I support this, but let's not lose sight of the fact that we are also tasking the Department of Education with a lot of jobs that are going to take a great deal of resources to accomplish. So we just need to keep all this in perspective.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I just want to make a brief comment before we vote on this. I appreciate the comments that have been made, but we have a pretty strong history also of local control in this state, and I encourage the school boards to look at some of the language programs that exist in the few areas where they do, because you'll find at most language immersion programs that exist in public schools in Oregon, you have waiting lists and lotteries to get in, and that shows you something about the demand. So the demand is definitely there, and I would encourage the local districts to start looking at these programs as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. The motion passes. The resolution is adopted. Senator Edwards will carry. And we'll close the work session at SJR 50. I saw Senator Zanski here. So let's go to
deja vu all over again.
1041. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1041. Senator Przanski is here with John Brown.
Would you like me to do a quick introduction, Mr. Chair? Senate Bill 1041 permits any agency to declare certain personal property that's deposited, left, or displayed in an area that's owned by the state as a public nuisance. It also modifies some of the existing provisions regarding disposition of personal property with regard to storage in particular. There is no revenue or fiscal impact from the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Floyd Przanski, State Senator for Senate District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. I'm here today with a good friend, John Brown. John and I have known each other for a number of years back in Eugene. We have served together on the Eugene Police Commission for, I believe, for a six-year period. And over that time, which has been some time in the past, we've got to know each other quite well. And I can tell you that Mr. Brown is an individual that's very avid regarding our waterways. He's a native Oregonian and an individual who is rich in his traditions of making sure that we protect them from all types of intrusions, including, as he will tell you about, debris and other type of waste that is coming into the water systems because we're not able to give proper management of those areas. Current law requires when you have such as items that are found on in public areas of the public lands close to waterways, a requirement that the agencies that have authority or jurisdiction over them, that they have to either post and or if they are going to remove the property, have to store it for a period of 30 days before they can take any action with it. John is going to share with you today just a snapshot of some of the stuff that he has dealt with and some of the cleanup efforts he has had in the Eugene Springfield area, both on the Willamette River and the McKenzie River. I also know that he may share with you to show you the extent of this, that it's not just on public property, but also what has happened in other areas of either private property or areas where there are right-of-ways on the Deschutes River. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm in another committee and we're getting ready to vote and I need to move a bill for my chair over there. I ask to be excused.
Absolutely. I think Mr. Brown can handle himself.
He can.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hask, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Brown, 101 East Broadway, Eugene, 97401. Also, for the record, my testimony today is personal and does not represent any position from any board or commission, which I may be a member of currently or in the past.
Yeah.
My testimony today is in support of Senate Bill 1041 dealing with abandoned or deposited property and rights of ways on state-owned property. By way of background, I have been very active in supporting the protection of our state waterways, including sponsoring, supporting legislation, testifying at public hearings and rules and regulations, and I continue to actively support it financially, organize, and participate hands-on in the cleanup projects throughout the state. Much of my efforts have been concentrated in the urban core areas such as Eugene and Springfield. The vast majority of the land adjacent to the Willamette and the McKenzie River is in public ownership, including many areas underneath highway bridges and overpasses. What has come to my attention is that these areas provide a form of relief for the at-risk and transient populations from the elements. In such, these areas are also become huge depositories for abandoned camping materials, stolen goods, or human toilets and general litter. When contacting the appropriate agencies to assist in the cleanup, whether it be the logistics or the access, they have been reluctant to participate as they have stated that there's a state law that requires them to store any materials for up to 30 days. It's very costly and very unhealthy conditions from storage, and so what has happened is they're not doing anything. The last three pictures of my testimony will tell you that all of that material washed into the Willamette River because I wasn't able to get it out of there either logistically or for a variety of reasons, and that's a Class 1 stream with protected species, and it's also the source of many residents' drinking water. I found that it's much easier to be proactive than reactive in these cleanup efforts, and what I'm trying to do here is be more efficient. This bill was created for the purpose of allowing state agencies to make the declaration that in situations such as these that they can exempt the material from the storage requirement and dispose of it before they enter the waterways. That's the reason to the genesis of this bill, nothing more, nothing less. It's intended to help protect our waterways. I fully understand the concerns of people that will testify after me today in opposition to the bill. But I also hope that there's some way we can find resolution and a meeting of the minds where we can find a win-win solution so we can not allow this to continue to destroy the integrity of our very, very valuable resource, our public water. And in closing, I'll tell you, there's, as Senator Prezansky indicated, there is also a situation which I'm pursuing now on the Deschutes River between Trout Creek and Maupin, where there's over 1,000 railroad ties that have been cut and thrown down the bank. Many, many of them are entering the waterways, and I'm getting the same response from the same entities, from the railroad and et cetera, and I'm not going away. I'm going to pursue it as far and with the resources I have to make sure that this doesn't occur. But it's another example of a system that hopefully can be altered somehow to allow people to better protect our natural resources. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? These pictures are pretty graphic, telling. I see some plastic bags in those messes there.
Mr. Chair. A question. I think this is a good piece of legislation, but I'm wondering if the language, if I'm reading the language correctly on line 7, any personal property that is not junk as defined in ORS 377.605, which looking at 377.605, highway beautification, motorist signs, definitions of junk, which would, the definitions would cover the kind of trash that you show in your pictures. But as I read it, any personal property that is not junk, as defined in ORS 377.605, may be declared a public nuisance. Is that language correct, colleagues?
As you just read it, the deletion of...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way I read it also is a double negative, possibly. Any personal property that is not junk as defined by ORS, and if the ORS defines the junk, and so what I would believe that it could possibly want to say any personal property that is
junk
and remove the word not, yes, potentially, as because it's already defined in the Highway Beautification Act.
Right.
And
you read that one?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to, so I can see what you say right now. I'm trying to think of,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, you said in your testimony that you've never once displaced a homeless person or disrupted a camp that may be occupied. Is that easy to tell from when you're out there working if a camp is occupied? Like, what if somebody, a homeless person left for a while and then comes back and finds nothing there? I mean, you wouldn't know necessarily that somebody was there? I'm just trying to figure out how you know that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I frequent the rivers as much as I can, and the predominance of these occur in from the spring through the end of the summer when the deciduous riparian areas provide them cover, and it's very difficult for people to see. I can see them. I know where they camp, and they're pretty much occupied during that period. But as soon as the rains start and as soon as the leaves leave, they're fully exposed, and they'll go for a month or two without anybody being there, and you can pretty much tell when there's nobody there. I have never actively engaged. I mean, I have compassion. I do quite a bit for the homeless, and no way would I ever or do anybody else. There's a lot of health hazards too. There's a lot of human waste. There's a lot of biohazard issues with needles and other things, and so a lot of them I don't deal with. The state under the right of the highways and the overpasses are where the preponderance of this occurs during the inclement weather, and the unfortunate thing is the water still rises 10 to 30 feet, as we know, and it can do it in a 48-hour period, and every bit of that material enters the waterway, and there's no way almost to get it out. It just comes this way.
Thank you.
Okay. Sure. I read this bill as much more expansive than waterway issues. This is all state-owned property. We had an occasion in my district on state right-of-way where it was just a mess, and the state went in ODOT with a front-end loader and trucks and hauled it off to the landfill. I mean, it just wasn't acceptable. You know, this homeless situation is tragic, but where they wind up congregating and creating density, that's a problem also. So I see this bill is very, very broad.
Okay. Thank you, John. We have Andrea Meyer, ACLU, signed up, and Monica Gorky.
Chair Hodge and members of the committee, my name is Monica Goracki, and I'm an attorney for the Oregon Law Center. As you may know, the Oregon Law Center's mission is to achieve access to justice for vulnerable, low-income Oregonians and their communities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about Senate Bill 1041. I'm currently the managing attorney for Oregon Law Center's office that serves the 10 counties of Northwest Oregon. In my work, I have represented and spoken to many homeless individuals about the legal and social problems they face. Many homeless men and women have recently escaped domestic violence, are elderly, or have physical or mental disabilities. In the Portland area, about 1,600 homeless people sleep outside every night because they cannot afford housing and the shelters are full. In rural areas, homeless people often camp because there are no shelters. Sleeping outside is dangerous. You risk your life and whatever personal property you've managed to hold on to all night, every night. Losing valuable and necessary property like tents, sleeping bags, and irreplaceable personal items like eyeglasses, birth certificates, makes it even harder for my clients to end their homelessness. I want to acknowledge very clearly and strongly that abandoned personal property can be annoying, unsightly, and a potential health and safety risk. I think companies, citizens, and homeless campers should be responsible and should clean up their mess. My concern in testifying before you today is that these proposed changes to Senate Bill 1041 will inadvertently have severe consequences for already vulnerable residents of Oregon. State law currently requires municipalities and counties to adopt humane policies toward homeless campers. It's ORS 203.077-2081. Under these statutes, law enforcement must give 24-hour notice of camp sweeps. Social service agencies must be informed so they can do outreach and try to help the campers. Personal property must be stored for at least 30 days. These requirements do place a burden of time and expense on local governments, but the legislature recognized that losing everything you own is disproportionately devastating to homeless individuals. While these statutes protect homeless individuals who camp on county or city lands, they do not protect those who camp on state-owned property. ODOT routinely destroys camps with no notice or property storage, and I know of many people who have lost everything they own in an ODOT sweep. Very recently, I was contacted by a couple who had sought shelter under the Ross Island Bridge during the surprise one-day snowstorm that we had right at the end of December, this just in the end of 2009. So in the morning, this couple left their camp, and they went to the social service agency where they can get warm and take a shower and pick up their mail. And they came back later that day, and everything was gone. Their bedding, their clothes, and their photographs. And they talked to some people, and it was clear that it was an ODOT sweep, people that had seen what happened. And that was a very cold night for them. In the past, my office has held discussions with ODOT about making its camp sweep policies more humane, but I don't believe any changes have been made. I'm concerned that the changes you're currently considering would make it even worse for homeless people who make the mistake of camping on state-owned property. It's usually often very difficult to know who owns a particular piece of land, and this bill would create completely inconsistent procedures for camp cleanups. It seems unfair to me that a homeless person would either lose everything or have a chance to get it back, just depending on what side of the property line they're where they're camping. I do understand that the goal of these proposed changes to SB 1041 is to help the government clean up our beautiful Oregon environment. And I believe there are ways to achieve this goal without putting homeless people further at risk. For example, some form of notice should be included, and there may be ways to assist homeless individuals in finding storage options for property that is truly of value to them. Given that your timelines are very short this session, I think this issue needs some additional consideration, and I'd be happy to assist however I can. And thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you. Take Andrea, and then we'll go to questions.
Chair House, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon. Excuse me. I'm here today in opposition of Senate Bill 1041, especially in the context of this very short session. We recognize some of the important issues that are being brought forward by Mr. Brown and the tensions that are at place, but we want to come up with solutions that are not only do not have unintended consequences, but those could include potential constitutional vulnerabilities. One person who could not be here today but wanted to very much is Mark Joyn, who heads up JOIN, J-O-I-N, which is an organization in Portland that has very successfully for many years put folks who are homeless into permanent housing. He's quite concerned about this legislation and would have wanted to come testify. Prior to his being the executive director of JOIN, he actually headed up the homeless project at Oregon Law Center and then was in private practice. So he brings both real world and sort of legal context experience to it. And I think a lot of our concerns are reflected by consistent with Oregon Law Center's and Monica's testimony. And, you know, as you heard, there are thousands of and increasingly higher numbers of folks who are homeless and who are desperate to seek shelter. And many of these individuals have everything with them. And it's devastating, as you can imagine, to lose your identification, your medications, all your legal documents, let alone your warm clothing and your other personal things. So that's the risk with legislation that is written and creates a significant risk to homeless folks who might leave their camp early one morning and return to find everything gone. Under Senate Bill 1041, when value property is removed by the state as a risk to public health and safety and welfare, and first of all, risk is a very broad term, there is no requirement that the state provide notice that it's removed the property, and there's no requirement that the state store the removed property for even a short period of time. This stands, as Monica already testified, in stark contrast with other parts of Oregon law that direct municipalities and local entities as to how to handle that. The constitutional concerns I would want to raise would be, again, I'm confident unintended consequences, but they would be Fourth Amendment requirements of both seizure and due process. The city of Fresno recently settled a federal judge giving a huge case where the federal judge gave final approval about a year and a half ago to a historic $2.35 million class action settlement to hundreds of Fresno homeless residents. The judge had previously ordered that the city and California Department of Transportation had violated the homeless residents' constitutional rights in the practice of immediately seizing and destroying personal property. So we want to make sure that whatever we craft in Oregon is both sound and humane policy, is consistent Oregon law, and complies with our Constitution. We are happy to join the other stakeholders, and I think there probably are more than are here today, to talk about this and hope that this would be something to be considered for 2011, but not in the next 5 days. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
One might be that if I think the intent would be to keep these things from washing down the rivers, and if this were narrowed to sensitive riverways or riverbanks, that sort of thing, would you still have your objections?
Chair House, I mean, our objections of if the government is going to take property, there is still the need to post, and if they have to remove it, if there's an inherent risk, there might be some standard, and I'll let Monica address this question as well. But then you also have retention issues that need to happen. So there are, it's you know, there are tools to remove property, and I'm not as familiar with the whole area of the law in terms of if something's floating down a river or the hazardous issues. I think there are processes available to immediately seize. You know, I think if there's a weapon or something, it can be immediately seized as a hazard rather than giving notice before you take it versus in other situations where notice is more appropriate. Did you want to?
Well, I think my concern would really be as well around giving people a little more time to clean up the camp and a place to store their belongings. And I guess it is a bit of apples to oranges when you look at those pictures, and it does look very messy. And yet when I look at them, I see items that people might be relying on. And I know government agencies are reluctant to look through and say, okay, this is junk, and oh gosh, this looks like a folder full of somebody's needed belongings. But that's crucial to the homeless person. And if that stuff is just picked up and summarily destroyed, even if it's next to the river, they have no chance to get it back. And it's just so devastating. So if changes were going to be made, I'd just hope for some amount of retention of the property.
Questions? Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would seem to, in light of your testimony, that the language is rather sweeping with respect to declaring what is, a public safety issue. If we didn't distinguish between what is a nuisance and what is public safety, but required a notice period that if you have a site, that it be posted with a notice that I don't know what the day, the number of days required would be appropriate to still meet the context of the ruling in California. Is that something that's a solution to this problem?
I think it could be a partial solution. I mean, it's ORS 203.079 sets out the required elements of local government policies on homeless camping, and it requires a 24-hour notice to be posted. And I know that in the context of state lands, ODOT has taken the position that they can put up permanent signs that say, you know, no, this is trespassing, or no trespassing private lands, or I'm not sure exactly what they say, but that's sufficient. And the problem is that, you know, when someone's homeless and they, you know, they're going to do their best to comply with the law, but they're also sort of without any resources. And so if it seems like a place where they can camp, they're probably going to do it. And just that, you know, that effort to provide 24 hours notice, I think would make a big difference. I think it was a pretty quick time to analyze this. I see that in Section 1 of the amendments, there's a requirement to provide 5 days after written notice or posting a notice. So I think maybe that might just cover it right there. But I think the retention is the other issue. I mean, there are times when people feel like they really have to camp a ways away from going to town to get their mail or go to the doctor or whatever. So they may actually have to leave for some time, and then they do want to come back and get their stuff.
Chair, Senator Morris, I think what you're hearing from us a little bit today is hopefully both a desire to look at this in terms of the state and the issues that are raised, but in the context of having a different statute in place that I think has some protections provisions, and maybe that's the vehicle. And then we're looking at wanting to make sure that we don't write something that gives government officials or entities the wrong direction, that without notice, without storage, leads them down the road to what was egregiously occurring in Fresno, California, which was going into the camps, even people there, and just taking and seizing significant amounts of property, destroying it right in front of them, or removing it and giving them no options. Again, I want to reiterate, I don't think that's what's, hopefully, that's not a situation that's happening in any part of Oregon. But I think we want to craft this carefully. And I'm not sure it's working through this version rather than working through ORS 203077, seeing what in that statute might not work or needs to be fixed. And I'm reluctant just because I'm about as well-versed on this in terms of the timelines and the people who really are knowledgeable, not all of them can be here. And so, again, one of them, I mean, in particular, and so, again, I think we really do want to have the chance to sit down and go, is there a way to address some issues here that haven't been further or previously examined in the Oregon legislature that allows for a little bit more leeway in some situations without going too far.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I do think this may be more complicated than we should be dealing with now. I guess one of the things that concerns me is the legislature has set a standard for other governments, and then they're going to set a different standard for ourselves. And I think that's troubling. There should be some uniform standard that all levels of government comply to, so there's no confusion. And this does set a different standard for the state than what we've imposed on municipalities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps I should have asked this question when Senator Brzezinski was here, because it's my understanding that this is applying to, it says, in an area under state ownership. But then under paragraph 2, it says if you give the 5 days written notice, if you know who the owner of the property is, or you post the notice if the owner of the property cannot be determined. And I thought we're dealing with state property, which should be pretty easy to determine who.
Personal property.
Your personal property.
Yeah, the personal property that's on the property.
Well, you post the notice there, and then that gives 5 days, correct?
Well,
and you were talking about 24 hours, so I'm trying to figure out how this is going to work.
Well, I'll jump in, and then Chair House, Senator Bonamici, I think that's where the property, I think, will be before it's sold or otherwise disposed of. So the 24 hours that Monica's talking about is notice that, I think, this campsite, we will be removing items here
right.
to give folks the opportunity
right.
to actually collect their belongings or return from a day away trying to get social services, and they come back to their site, and that evening they find the notice. So they have the time within that 24-hour period, hopefully, to have seen that notice to be able to collect their property. This has to do with once it's been collected, so you did the 24-hour notice, you took the property before it can be disposed of. In other words, I mean, it's the idea of, and I think that's where you also start getting into some due process issues and constitutional issues, because you often see those cars parked in on property, state property or local property. You see the sticker goes up first. Notice is there, and then the car is seized, but I don't believe the state can instantly sell it and make profit from it or do any, if that's even possible with some of those cars, but they have to give the opportunity for the owner to retrieve it. I don't know the details of cars, but it's that idea that you can't quickly convert the property, sell it, and have that government action without sufficient due process. Monica,
I guess this is a little bit of a separate point, but the other sort of concern around this is that if this 5-day notice only comes into play when an agency has decided that the personal property poses no risk to public health, safety, or welfare, and I can really easily imagine a situation where there's a number of items at a camp, and you can say, well, some of this is clearly shouldn't be here, you know, if there's no toilet and someone's decided to use a certain area as a toilet, but there may be other property there that someone does really need, and so is the whole site going to be declared, you know, a public nuisance, or will they separate out which parts are, you know, needed or someone's valuable property or not? So these are things that I think we just need a little more thought, and I'm pretty sure we could help, and, you know, these issues could be dealt with, but the way this is written, I think, would be so broad that you would see a lot more camp sweeps where people just are devastated.
Okay.
Thank you.
No one else left to testify on this bill. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 1041, and we will talk to the sponsors and see where we would go from here.
Mr. Chair, would you like to carry it over in case you'd like to do something on Wednesday?
Carry it over to Wednesday session. There's no other business?
Are we going to send this to rules or not?
Which one?
It's posted as subsequent referral to rules. Were you going to send it there? Or?
That would be the next step. We're just going to leave it here.
No, I'm sorry. On that one, Mr. Chair, SJR 48 will carry, you've announced, we'll carry that over to Wednesday.
Okay. Right. Okay.
But we're not going to take
okay.
it forward.
Well, I just want to make sure you carry it if you're there. Okay.
Perfect.
thought we did Brandon Hall. I thought we did SJR 48 last session.
We did.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Senator Morris, you look quizzical.
Well,
are you upset with the Ducks Beavers?
Well, I was prepared to come and talk about Oregon State football today. I didn't get a chance to do that.
Yeah.
The testimony is pretty compelling, and if the sponsors want to bring this back, I think there has to be some amendments. I think the not needs to be deleted to make it read right. And the idea of providing notice, if we're dealing with 24 hours now, that seems to be a little tight to me. You know, 5-day, and then don't distinguish between public nuisance and public safety. So it's just a 5-day notice. You know, I can think of circumstances where, you know, you got a snowstorm that hits, and they go in and give 24-hour notice, and the people are just devastated. I mean,
if the standards we've set for municipal governments is working relatively well, why
24-hour notice?
Well, there's other things as far as retention of personal property for 30 days and things like that, which is somewhat onerous, but we've determined that that's good enough for municipal governments and fair to the people who own the property. Why would we set a different standard for us? You know,
this almost smacks of the boot heel of government.
Yeah.
And when these people are down and out, there needs to be some consideration and thoughtful handling of these.
I've got rooms in my house that look that messy.
I think there's a way to get there. And I know Mark Jolin, and he would be really helpful on this issue. He just couldn't be here today from Join, who Andrea mentioned. He knows this.
There should be consistency between the standards municipalities have and standards state agencies have.
Are we in a work session? Or
yeah,
are we?
We're just still on.
Okay.
A tall order to be done in the next couple of days.
It is. And I think, you know, to carry this over interim and then bring it back in 11 is probably very appropriate.
That's probably reasonable. Yeah. As with many things we're dealing with this session.
What appears to be simple is not always simple.
Isn't that the truth? That was profound, but
agree. Oh, yeah.
That's my contribution for the day.
Thank you for that. We are adjourned.
Go Beavers!